Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for another Case Updates episode. I'm pretty sure I say this every single time, but I'm always so shocked recently at how often I'm filming these videos, but it does just fill my heart with joy because updates mean things are moving. Updates mean we're one step closer to justice, or we have justice, or someone finally has their name back. I love filming these videos for you. Today we have updates on a lot of huge cases, including one very high profile Jane Doe finally being identified, so get yourself settled. I have a feeling this is going to be a really long one. You may have also noticed that I do now do quick YouTube shorts as and when updates are released to the public in these cases, just so I can share the news with you guys as quickly and as immediately as possible. But of course, those shorts can only be 60 seconds long, so these longer case updates are going to be where I share all the details a little bit later on, where we have a lot more information. So do keep an eye out on my channel for any YouTube shorts. Of course, as always, my full videos for each case I'm going to be talking about today will be linked in the description box down below, just in case you want to go and learn more. And I will be donating a large portion of the profits of this video towards one of the cases I'm going to be talking about. So if you are able to, it would mean a lot if you can sort of watch the ads all the way through, or just watch them as long as you can stand to. Sort of the higher we get the AdSense up, the more money I can donate. I did try and get a sponsor on this video so I could donate all the proceeds of that towards this cause, but that fell through last minute, so this is what we're going to do instead. We're going to start today with an update in The Princes in the Tower, a case that I did suspect we would soon have an update on when King Charles recently took the throne, and it turns out I was correct. I have a feeling this case is going to be a continuing feature in my updates videos over the next couple of years, because stuff is just going to keep coming out. The case of the Princes in the Tower refers to the disappearance and suspected murder of two young princes many, many centuries ago, all the way back in 1483. 12-year-old King Edward V and 9-year-old Richard of Shrewsbury, Duke of York, were the only surviving sons of King Edward IV when he suddenly died. And seeing as the new King Edward was so young, his father's brother, Uncle Richard, was designated as Lord Protector. Richard placed the boys in the Tower of London for their safety, as well as the fact that at the time it was very traditional for a monarch to stay there until their coronation. However, Uncle Richard soon declared the boys as illegitimate because their father was supposedly contracted to marry another woman before he wed their mother, therefore making the marriage invalid and the boys no longer in line for the throne. Worked out quite nicely for Uncle Richard, as he was the next in line for the throne, and he was swiftly crowned as King Richard III. The boys were then moved to the innermost chambers of the Tower of London, and then they just disappeared. They were reportedly last seen around spring-summer 1483, and nobody knows what happened to them. Rumours that they had been murdered did almost immediately start circulating around London, but there was no evidence one way or the other. Until in July 1674, so almost 200 years later, when workmen working on the Tower of London found a wooden box underneath the staircase that contained two very small human skeletons. It's long been assumed that these two skeletons were those of the missing princes, but this was the 1600s, it's not like they could DNA test the remains, so they were just placed in an urn, and on the orders of King Charles II, they were interred at Westminster Abbey, alongside numerous other monarchs and royals. And then, another couple hundred years later, in 1933, modern testing for the time was done on these remains, and it was confirmed that the bodies were aged about 10 and 12, but nothing further could be discerned. With today's modern technology though, it's very much believed that we would finally be able to get a definitive answer as to whether the remains were the princes, but Queen Elizabeth always refused to allow this testing to happen. The DNA testing has always been refused on the grounds that it could set a precedent for testing historical remains that could lead to multiple different royal disinterments. I mean, this is by far not the only royal historical mystery. Full DNA testing could answer a lot of historians' questions. Oh, our co-host Rhubarb has come to join us. Do you want to say hi to everyone? Say hi. Ooh. This is Rhubarb, she's going to co-host for a little bit. Hopefully you won't mind her purring on my lap. People have said in the past they don't mind her purring, but just in case. As I was saying, people were also concerned what would happen if the DNA test came back as negative. What do you do with the remains then? And also, although it's never been explicitly said by the officials, I do suspect there was also a lot of hesitation in case it threw the Queen's place on the throne into question. What if this DNA testing proved that she wasn't the rightful heir? There were very strong calls from the Richard III Society back in 1995 for this testing to be done, but apparently the Queen and the then Home Secretary and the Prime Minister were in full agreement this matter should not be reopened. And those calls for testing grew even stronger back in 2012, when the remains of Richard III were found beneath a car park in Leicester, because now they literally had a direct relative of the Prince's to test against. But still, the Queen resisted. However, now King Charles is on the throne, it's said that he takes a very different stance. He is said to like an investigation to go ahead, so we can determine once and for all how the young royals died. However, the buck doesn't stop with the king here. Any forensic testing also needs to get consent from the Dean of Westminster as well. But if the king agrees to it, I don't see any reason why the Dean would refuse. This is all hypothetical right now. As far as I can tell, no actual steps have been made towards this. And I doubt it's right at the top of the to-do list for the palace, but fingers crossed movements will be made soon. The first step would be carbon dating of the bones, which basically means a small sample would have to undergo radiocarbon dating to determine whether the bones are even from the right time period. If the bones are found to be not from this time period, then there's your answer right there, it literally couldn't be the prince's. But if they are from the right time, then you go on to do genetic analysis. Scientists do have the Y chromosome of Richard III extracted from his remains, and if the other remains are indeed the prince's, his genetic nephews, they would have the same Y chromosome. However, this is all dependent on the fact that there's sufficient DNA left in the remains. If there's not, that's a whole other hurdle to overcome, if even can be. If this is all done though, it will be a huge step towards solving one of the most enduring British mysteries. But scientists are advocating for it to be done properly. They want peer-reviewed and published as a scientific study in a measured and non-sensationalist manner. And then if the testing reveals that the remains are not genetically related to Richard III, that opens up a whole other can of worms. Who do the remains belong to? How did they get there? Where did the princes go? I think my last update on this case was about clues that perhaps the princes were sent to live in Devon, where Edward took on a new persona as a man called John Evans. I won't go into all of that again, but I will leave a link to that video down below where I talked about that. I'm certainly going to be keeping a very close eye on this one going forward. Hopefully it will be announced soon that things are actually moving here. And I probably should say as well that even if we do get confirmation that these are the remains of the princes, that's not going to confirm who they were murdered by. I don't know if we'll ever be able to get confirmation of that. But if they are, chances are it might be Richard III or somebody very closely related to him. The second update I have for you today was a big news story in the case of Keith Bennett, a 12-year-old victim of Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, the Moors murderers. Now, I did debate sharing this update because nothing actually came of it, but an update is an update regardless whether something was found, and I did say in my YouTube short about this I would keep you all in the loop. So the Moors murders refers to five children killed by Brady and Hindley in the 1960s, four of whom were buried in the Saddleworth Moor, and whilst four of the victims' bodies have been found, so one at Brady and Hindley's home and the rest in the Moors, Keith Bennett's body has never been found, although it has been confirmed he was indeed a victim. Keith disappeared whilst he was on his way to see his grandmother in Chalton-on-Medlock in Manchester on the 16th of June 1964, and his mother, Winnie Johnson, spent the rest of her life trying to find her son's body. She never ever gave up until the day she died in 2012, and she even appealed directly to the murderers multiple times for answers, and just spent many days in the moors by herself, armed with just a spade, just digging to find her son. It is tragic. At the end of September this year, so 2022, an author and investigator called Russell Edwards came forward saying that he was convinced he had found Keith's remains. He'd spent the last 7 years looking for him in the moors. Edwards phoned the Greater Manchester Police saying he had evidence to suggest that Keith's remains were buried close to where the remains of three other murder victims had been found. He had evidence, including soil samples, that suggested a human body had been buried in the area. He said that in July 2022, he was making one final search of the moors when he took a sample near Eagle Rock. He took the sample from the middle of a long patch of strangely white grass that was strangely grave-sized, about 5 foot by 3 foot. He said that most of the time when he was taking soil samples, you tend to hit granite or stone, but the sample stick just went in very easily this time, suggesting this ground had previously been dug. He sent these samples to a geologist at Northumbria University who said that this may well be a burial site. Edwards also said that he'd found some white and blue material at the site, as well as an item that kind of looked like part of a human skull. A forensic archaeologist called Dawn Keane, who specialises in the study of human remains, is also reported to have remotely supervised this grave cut, and she said that she believed there are human remains there, saying that she saw what seemed to be the left side of an upper jaw. She said she could see the canines, incisors and first molar. Although the police were hesitant, it seems, they did take the report seriously and they began their own search. However, just 4 days later, Detective Chief Inspector Cheryl Hughes said that forensic archaeologists and forensic anthropologists had completed a methodical archaeological excavation and examination of the area, and no bones, fabric, or items of interest were recovered from the soil. Despite this, the search was continuing in a wider surrounding area. Hughes also said that the photograph showing an item that Edward said was part of a human skull appeared to be considerably smaller than juvenile jaw, and it cannot be ruled out that it is plant-based. The search ended on the 7th of October with investigators saying they found nothing, they found no remains. Keith's closest surviving relative now is his brother, Alan Bennett, and he's criticised the fact that Edward seems to go to the press with this information before he went to the police. He said that this is not the first time that somebody had done this, and every time it happens, it causes pain, anguish, and distress for the entire family. Writing on Facebook, Alan said, "I have had to explain things to my own grandchildren in more detail recently, and the older they get, the more questions they have. I am struggling to explain what makes certain people tick and behave the way they do, this latest example being one of the most difficult to even attempt to explain. I'm biting my lip very hard and biding my time, but the truth will be told. I will make sure of that." Alan didn't believe for a moment, it seems, that his brother had been found, and sadly, this instinct was correct. I can't imagine being in such a position, being told time and time again over the years that his brother was finally going to be able to be found, to be reunited with his family, be laid to rest properly. But it just never turns out to be anything. Your hope must just get slowly chipped away over the years. But I do really hope for Alan that one day a lead will turn out to be correct and Keith's body will finally be found. As you can imagine, there has been a lot of criticism aimed at Russell Edwards over all of this, saying that this was just a publicity stunt to promote his books. A lifelong amateur investigator and author, he first came into the public eye in 2014 after publishing a book called Naming Jack the Ripper, where after years of research, he produced what he called the definitive evidence to prove the identity of Jack the Ripper, apparently thanks to modern DNA testing. A lot of scientists called him out on this at the time, but he's not the first person to claim that he's identified Jack the Ripper, and I'm sure that he's not going to be the last. I personally like to think the best of people. I like to think this was not a publicity stunt on Edward's behalf and he really did think he'd found something worth investigating. He's reportedly searched the moors for Keith since 2015 and has now said that he took his investigation as far as possible and he will not return to the moors. He has nowhere else to search, he says. Investigators have always said in this case that if you have any potential information, they will follow it. They want to be able to provide closure to Alan and the rest of Keith's surviving family. They want to do Winnie justice. The Greater Manchester Police have stressed the investigation into Keith Bennett's death has been open since 1964 and it will not be closed until his family have answers. So they are always willing to listen to any leads people might have, even if it leads to another dead end. According to The Guardian, the Assistant Chief Constable, Sarah Jackson, has said, "We have always said that we would respond in a timely and appropriate manner to any credible information which may lead us towards finding Keith. Our actions in the last week or so are a highly visible attempt of what that response looks like, with the force utilising the knowledge and skills of accredited experts, specialist officers and staff." She goes on to say that although there is no evidence of the presence of human remains at this site on Saddleworth Moor, she wants to make it clear that their investigation to find answers for Keith's family is not over. I also have a smallish update for you in the JonBenet Ramsey case, which is something that I didn't think I'd ever be saying on this channel. I don't think I need to give you a synopsis on JonBenet's case, we all know it. On the 9th of November, so just a couple of weeks ago now, the Boulder Police Department and the Boulder County District Attorney's Office in Colorado sent out a news release announcing there was an update in the ongoing homicide investigation. We're now approaching the 26th anniversary of JonBenet's murder, and the news release states that since then, detectives have investigated leads stemming from more than 21,000 tips, and they've travelled to 19 different states to speak to more than 1,000 people. To this day, the investigation receives assistance from federal, state, and local partners, including the FBI, and now several private DNA labs across the country. That's right, they're talking about utilising DNA testing to try and get answers in JonBenet's case, and this could potentially be huge. The DNA evidence they say they have in this case is said to be extremely small and complex, consisting of unidentified DNA found in JonBenet's underwear, and touch DNA was also discovered on the waistband of her long johns. The problem, they say, is that this sample could potentially be consumed by DNA testing, which is to say that if they attempt the testing and something goes wrong, they lose the only evidence they have. This news release states there have been several discussions with private DNA labs about the viability of continued testing of this DNA, and these discussions remain ongoing. Whenever there is proven technology that can reliably test forensic samples consistent with the sample they have available here, they have said that additional analysis will be conducted. So basically, they're saying it in quite a roundabout way, but what I think they're saying is that they're fully intending to do forensic and most likely full genealogical genetic testing on this DNA when the tech is ready for it. And that's exciting because we're all seeing how fast the tech is improving in this area. However, I must say, we have already seen the incredible things that current tech can do. Companies like Othram, who I'll talk about later in the video. I do find it hard to believe they couldn't do this testing now. Last year, the Major Crimes Unit announced they'd analysed nearly 1,000 DNA samples to find no matches, but I don't think the full genetic testing has happened yet, like the testing to the extent we see in a lot of Jane Doe cases, for example. It just doesn't seem like they have enough material for this, but I do admit that the articles around this are quite confusing. They're sort of very contradictory. They've also said that in 2023, they're going to be consulting with the Cold Case Review Team to look at what else they can do in this case. The Cold Case Review Team is comprised of professional, investigative, analytical and forensic experts from across the state, and they will make recommendations on what the next best steps are here. I know we all have our own opinions about what happened to JonBenet Ramsey and who's responsible for her murder, but what I will say is that her family does very much seem to be behind this news, and they're the ones pushing for these movements to happen. Since the very beginning of this case, the Ramsey family have been very critical of the Boulder Police Department's handling of this case, mostly because they were all considered suspects for a very long time. John Ramsey, JonBenet's father, spoke at CrimeCon this summer to pressure police into retesting this evidence, and he said that people need to sign a petition calling on the Colorado governor to hand over decision-making power regarding DNA evidence from the local police to an independent agency. Of course, I will leave that petition linked in the description box. It certainly seems like the statement the police made earlier this month might be on the back of this public pressure. John is still criticising the police, saying that if it stays in the hand of the Boulder PD, he doesn't think this case will ever be solved, especially because apparently it's still in the hands of the same two detectives from 1996, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see. If this DNA is tested and they do find who it belongs to, it certainly could provide more answers here. I think they need to get DNA to Othram, who are doing incredible things in this field right now. If anyone get any answers here, Othram can do it. Next up, we have some huge news in the case of Renee McRae. Yes, I am pronouncing her name correctly. I have to say that disclaimer every time I mention Renee, otherwise I get destroyed in the comments, and I'm very sensitive. 36-year-old Renee McRae and her 3-year-old son Andrew disappeared on the 12th of November 1976 from near Inverness in Scotland. Her car was found burned out on the side of the A9. That night, Renee had dropped her older son Gordon off at her estranged husband's house before heading south on the A9 towards Perth, apparently on her way to visit her sister with her youngest son, Andrew. No trace of Andrew or Renee have ever been found. All that was found was a rug stained with blood matching Renee's blood type. There was certainly enough evidence present at this scene to suggest that they had been murdered. However, investigation into this found a twisted web of a personal life, as it seemed that Reaney had been having an affair with a man called William McDowell, known as Bill, for the last 5 years. Andrew, it turns out, was Bill's biological son, and despite what she told her estranged husband, Reaney wasn't actually planning on going to see her sister that night. She was on her way to see Bill. She was apparently completely and totally in love with him, only Bill was married. According to a friend that Reaney confided in, Bill had told Reaney that he'd found a job with Texaco in Shetland, and he'd found a house where they all could live, all of which, unbeknownst to Reaney, turned out to be lies. And then Reaney and Andrew disappeared. Over the years, multiple searches have been conducted in a search for their bodies, mostly focused around Dalmagerry Quarry, to no avail. The latest search was as recent as 2019 and still nothing. For a very long time, no one was arrested in connection with these disappearances or murders, but Bill McDowell was always a prime suspect. Despite intensive investigation over the years, there was never enough to arrest him though. Until September 2019, when McDowell was finally charged not only with the murders, but also with two charges of attempting to pervert the course of justice. Now 80-year-old McDowell faced trial in September of this year, with the jury being told how Reaney was on her way to visit him for a weekend with their son. She believed they'd be moving to Shetland very, very soon. McDowell was living near Inverness at the time, and he was a secretary at the building firm owned by Reaney's estranged husband. The whole affair was a bit of a tangled mess. When the affair was uncovered in the aftermath of the disappearance, McDowell would lose his job. At trial, it was explained how after Reaney and Andrew disappeared, he'd had the boot floor of his company car completely replaced, and he'd also refused to hand the car back until he'd had it scrubbed out top from bottom. His motive was said to be a growing concern that his affair was going to be revealed, something that would have been devastating for his finances and his lifestyle, which was said to be weirdly lavish for somebody of his pay grade. In his first interview with the police all the way back in the 70s, it's said that Bill initially denied any association with Reaney before confessing to the affair later that same day. However, at his trial a couple of months ago, he denied any involvement in Reaney and Andrew's disappearance. McDowell was wheeled in his wheelchair into the courtroom each day of the trial by his wife, Rosemary, who he was with then and he remains with until this very day. McDowell is now 80 years old, and many of the witnesses at the trial were now also very much into their old ages themselves. One of the youngest witnesses was 65-year-old Martin Shand, who testified how he had been returning from college in Dundee for the weekend when he spotted two vehicles in the lay-by where Reaney's BMW would later be found burnt out. The other car he saw was a Volvo, the same make as McDowell's company car, and it seems like pretty much all of the damning evidence in this case is centred around this company car. A man was also seen pushing a pushchair with what looked like belongings piled on top of it, and it turns out that Andrew had a very similar pushchair. McDowell's alibi changed multiple times over the coming months or years. He claimed that he was never near the A9 that night and he was home by 8:30 p.m, an alibi that at the time was backed up by his wife Rosemary, who was said to be very angry with police in questioning. However, in another statement, she stated that Bill didn't come home until after 10 p.m. that night, which was undermining the first alibi she'd given. On another occasion, when her husband had gone to the police station to provide information that had been requested, it said that Rosemary came in and just pulled him out, hindering the investigation. Other evidence in this case included a previous statement from a now deceased criminal called Dennis Tierney, who claimed that McDowell had offered to pay him to kill Reaney and Andrew with acid. Evidence also came out that McDowell had told his handyman at a pub that he did and didn't when asked if he had killed them. Obviously, this is hearsay, but it was mentioned at the trial. In the end, on the 29th September 2022, William McDowell was found guilty of the murders. The sentencing judge, Lord Armstrong, sentenced him to life imprisonment for the crime. The minimum period before he's eligible for parole was set at 30 years, but he is 80 years old, maybe even 81 now actually, so I'll let you do the maths there. Lord Armstrong said, "On the evidence at your trial, these murders appear to have been premeditated, planned and carried out by you in the most calculating way. It was not a spontaneous event which happened on the spur of the moment. These appear to have been, in effect, executions. You murdered your victims and then disposed of their bodies and personal effects, including the boy's pushchair, and then took various steps to conceal the crimes you had committed and to avoid detection. The murder of Rini is bad enough. To murder anyone is bad enough. But why Andrew as well? Why a 3-year-old boy? How messed up do you need to be to think that's something you need to do? Andrew would have had no memory of anything. He wouldn't have known who Bill was. It's that bit that really gets me. It goes to show just how depraved this murder was. Some people have said Andrew was killed just because he was there. A 3-year-old couldn't be left on the side of a busy road alone. But if this statement from the former criminal is to be believed, he always intended to kill Andrew. It makes my blood boil. Maura Govens, Rini's sister, made a statement through the family's advocate saying, "The pain of losing Rini and Andrew doesn't ease. Not a day passes when both are not in our thoughts. Andrew's life was cruelly and brutally cut short at such a young age, just 3 years old, and I often wonder what he would be doing now. The passage of time has not eased the anguish. We've not been allowed to grieve properly. Not knowing how Rini and Andrew died and where their remains lie compounds the anguish. I have never stopped trying to find justice for Rini and Andrew, who deserve to rest in peace. Thinking of the terror they must have felt when they died in such a calculated and callous way continues to haunt me." Of course, even though McDowell has now been convicted, we still don't know the whereabouts of Andrew and Rini's bodies, and it's very unlikely he's going to share anytime soon because he is still protesting his innocence. And from the looks of it, he is starting the process of an appeal. I guess we'll just have to wait and see how successful this appeal is. Moving on, I want to do something a little bit different and share with you a massive update in a case I haven't actually covered on my channel before, but it's one that I always get people asking me to talk about, and that's the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German in Delphi, Indiana in February 2017, also known as the Delphi Murders. Now, there are a multitude of reasons why I've never covered this case online and why I also don't intend to anytime soon, but mostly because this is a case that has been harmed by false reporting. It's also a case where the police have purposefully not publicly released all the evidence they have, so anyone reporting about this online is only really telling half the story. I very, very carefully choose the cases I want to talk about on my channel. I don't talk about recent cases, cases that are still being actively investigated, unless I've been directly contacted by a family member to do so. My aim is always to spread the word of cold or forgotten cases in a sort of attempt to rejuvenate public interest. And on the rare occasion I do talk about a solved case, it's something kind of with a moral or something to learn from. I've learned a lot in my years talking about true crime here on YouTube, and a lot of that includes the harm that incorrect reporting can do for a case, and I never, ever want to contribute to that. I kind of went on more of a tangent there than I intended to, but this is obviously something that's very important to me and to the ethics of my channel. Saying all of that, I do want to share some really incredible news that after almost 6 years, someone has finally been arrested in the Delphi case, and that's 50-year-old Richard Matthew Allen from Delphi. Abby and Libby were just 13 and 14 years old respectively when they went for a hike along the Delphi Historic Trails in February 2017 before not showing up to meet Libby's dad, who was picking them up. Their bodies were found the next day in a wooded area near the trail, only about half a mile from where they'd been dropped off at the Monon High Bridge. One of the only clues distributed by police was a video found on Libby's phone that showed a man seemingly following them in a blue jacket and blue jeans. Investigation has led authorities to believe that this person is a suspect in their murders, but the video doesn't give a clear picture of his face. And then on Monday, October 31st, 2022, it was announced that days beforehand, Richard Allen had been arrested and taken into custody, formally charged with 2 counts of murder. He is being held without bond in the White County Jail awaiting trial. Now, there has been no evidence released about what led to this arrest, and going forward they're not going to release anything. The probable cause affidavit and the charging document have been temporarily sealed because this investigation is far from over. Remember, this is a case of innocent until proven guilty. I mean, all cases are innocent until proven guilty. Allen has not yet faced trial. This case is not solved. Somebody has just been arrested. Right now, a pre-trial date is set for the 13th of January and a trial date is scheduled for March 20th, but as always, this is subject to change. These things are never straightforward. Which brings me to the main reason for mentioning this case in this video. There is currently a change.org petition being pushed by the girls' families to keep this arrest evidence sealed in order to ensure that this investigation is not jeopardised. I know people want to know what happened in this case, but that is far from the priority. That's not what the families want, and they are always the priority here. Justice for Abby and Libby is far more important than the public knowing the details of this case. It is the best way to ensure a fair and impartial trial, especially because this case went so viral. So I'm going to link the petition down below. Please go and sign it, and if you can share it as well, please do get as many signatures on this as possible to keep all this evidence sealed. Which brings us on to some Jane Doe cases, and we actually have something pretty important to discuss in the case of the LISC, the Long Island Serial Killer, or Gilgo Beach Killer, whatever you want to call them. I actually didn't know about this update until a subscriber actually messaged me on Instagram with a magazine article about this. So Cameron, if you're watching, thank you so much for that. All of you, please do feel free to send me a message if you hear about a case update you think I should know about. I actually do find out about most updates myself when you guys leave comments on old videos, so please do keep up with that. The name LISC refers to an unidentified serial killer who is suspected to be responsible for the murders of anywhere from 10 to 16 people over a period of nearly 20 years, so that's the 1990s through to the 2010s. The first remains were found on the south shore of Long Island, New York on December 11th, 2010, whilst authorities were searching for 24-year-old Shannon Gilbert, who had disappeared in the area in May of that same year. These remains found weren't Shannon. She would instead be found a couple of days later in marshland, a mile and a half from where she disappeared. But over the coming months, multiple more bodies would be found, many of whom still remain unidentified. I highly recommend you go and watch my full video on this one for the full story, but today we're going to be focusing on an update in one of the Jane Doe cases, a Jane Doe who has been nicknamed Peaches. Her body, or should I say dismembered human remains, were found on April 11th, 2011 near Jones Beach State Park. In 2016, DNA testing found that her remains could be linked to the torso of an unidentified black woman who had been found at Hempstead Lake State Park in Lakeview 14 years earlier. On her left breast, the victim had a tattoo of a heart-shaped peach with a bite out of it and two drips falling from its core, hence her nickname, Peaches. DNA testing also found that Peaches was the biological mother of another victim found at the scene, Baby Doe, who was thought to be between 16 and 24 months of age. Both Baby Doe and Peaches were found to be wearing very similar gold jewellery. In mid-October this year, it was announced via Facebook that the FBI are expanding their search for answers in Peaches and Baby Doe's cases. They're seeking relatives and friends of a man called Elijah Lige Howell, or Howard, born in 1927 and died in 1963. Mr. Howell is said to have lived in Pritchard, Alabama with his wife Carrie, and he passed away in Mobile, Alabama with a Miss Lily Mae Wiggins Packer. They really haven't shared a huge amount of information about why Elijah, but they have said that his relatives may be able to assist in the case of a woman and child found in another state. The photo of Peach's tattoo is included with that post, which lets us know that this request is linked to Peaches and Baby Doe. Anyone with any information is asked to call 1-800-CALL-FBI or leave a tip at www.tips.fbi.gov. I urge you, if you live in or near either of those areas I mentioned, please share this information. I'll leave a link down below to the Facebook post, which maybe you could share to your own pages, I don't know, however you can get the information out. This is pure speculation on my behalf, so please don't take it as fact, but I do suspect they've been doing familial genetic genealogy on Peach's remains, and this name has popped up on the family tree. The names coming up only take you so far though, you do really need to find these people and get further answers, and Elijah has passed. It seems like investigators have hit a dead end. According to the Long Island Press, records show that Elijah had three siblings himself, but they've also since died, but these siblings all had children of their own. It's unclear if Howard had children of his own. If he did, there's no missing persons reports to ever report anyone missing. It strikes me that they're really close to getting some answers here as to Peaches and Baby Doe's identity, and just maybe that could also be the puzzle piece that leads to the identity of their murderer as well, but they need to find Elijah or people who know Elijah first. The next Doe update I have for you is just a very small one in the case of the Tempe girl, something I want to share here just in case it could help. I covered this case originally back at the beginning of June, and I'm sure I said in that video that I really hoped it would be picked up by the DNA Doe Project soon,
And as if mine and many other people's prayers were answered, on the 26th of July, it was announced via Facebook that they had started working on Tempe Girl's case in partnership with the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office. She also became one of DNA Doe Project's spotlight cases for National Hispanic Heritage Month in September, when it was announced that her DNA matches so far indicated that she might be Peruvian or Mexican. On the 22nd of October, they wrote that she was very, very likely Peruvian, which brings up some roadblocks because Peruvians are not a population that's well represented in their current databases. They did strike two matches in the database though, to the anonymous names Bacon Castle and Baby. She is in these people's family trees somewhere, which is information that does bring us one step closer to our identity, but these DNA matches are extremely distant. DNA Doe Project have asked for two things to be able to help with this case: to share their Facebook post to your personal page and to Facebook groups. I'll leave it again linked down below, especially if you live in Arizona and the surrounding states and or are Peruvian or of Peruvian descent. As they state in this post, the more eyes on her face, the more likely she is to be recognised. The second thing you can do is to upload your DNA data to GEDmatch yourself if you feel comfortable doing so. As they point out, a greater representation of Latinx people in GEDmatch will help them solve Tempe Girl's case and other cases like hers. Her death has been ruled as an accident, so with her identification, the authorities really will have all their answers here, which is very rare in Doe cases. Tempe Girl's case is also one of their donate cases, with a funding goal of $2,100. This case needs additional funding to help cover the costs involved in solving it, for the expensive lab work and their team of investigative genetic genealogists to do the work. DNA Doe Project is a non-profit organisation, so they really rely on our donations to get these cases solved. I mentioned at the beginning of this video that I was going to be donating a portion of the profits to one of these cases I mentioned, and this is it, Tempe Girl's case. Hopefully you've been watching those ads all the way through. I know they're annoying, but just imagine the difference we can make in this case. We can donate a lot of money if people are watching those ads. And that brings us on to our final update of this video, which is the identification of the Lady of the Dunes after 48 years. In July 1974, the remains of a woman were discovered in the dunes about a mile east of the Race Point Ranger Station in Cape Cod, Provincetown, Massachusetts. Her cause of death was thought to have been a blow to the head, and she had been dead for several weeks when she was found. Her hands had also been removed, presumably by her murderer, so she couldn't be identified via fingerprints, and they'd made an effort to even sever her head from her body, although they hadn't quite succeeded. This case would become one of the most infamous unidentified people cases and cold cases in USA history. But on the 31st of October, it was announced by the FBI that she had finally been identified as Ruth Marie Terry, a 37-year-old woman from Tennessee. She had been born in Tennessee in 1936 and was a daughter, sister, aunt, wife, and mother. That's pretty much all the information about her that's been released publicly, and honestly, we the public aren't entitled to much more than that. If family do want to come out publicly and share more, that's entirely their prerogative. The public have played their part in this, they've kept her story at the forefront of history, but this case is far from solved. Hopefully her identification will help the search for her killer. Clearly this killer went to great lengths to ensure that she wouldn't be identified, which to me suggests that her identity would lead right to them. Investigators have announced they're specifically looking for any information about Ruth's ex-husband, Guy Rockwell Moldovan, who she married in February 1974, so just a few months before she died. He has also since died in California in 2002, but investigators are asking anyone with any information about the whereabouts of Ruth or Guy in New England in 1973 or 1974 to contact them. Guy was an antiques dealer who apparently also used the name, and I can never say his name properly, so excuse me, Raoul Guy Rockwell, and he was also a suspect in the deaths of a previous wife and stepdaughter in Seattle in 1960. He was eventually caught in New York and was charged with unlawful flight. It's somewhat of a coincidence that two of his wives have mysteriously died, isn't it? Hopefully we are going to get answers in this case one day. This case is being investigated as a homicide by the Massachusetts State Police and the FBI. They're asking that if anyone has any information concerning this case, particularly if you know anything about Ruth's movements in the days, weeks, months before her death, to contact the FBI's tip line again at 1-800-CALL-FBI, or you can submit a tip online at tips.fbi.gov or email msptips@poll.state.ma.us. Ruth was also known to use aliases including Terry Marie Vezina, Terry M. Vezina, and Terry Shannon, as she had ties to Michigan and California. Ruth was identified with the help of Othram Labs, who I've mentioned many times in my videos, even many times in this video. I even worked with them very briefly, I think last year, maybe the year before. They are doing really incredible things in the world of Doe identification and just the solving of cold cases in general. The FBI called on Othram to help them piece together Ruth's DNA, sending pieces of her skeletal remains. David Mittelman, the CEO of Othram, said that the FBI comes to them after they've exhausted every other avenue of identification, and they really had exhausted every avenue in this case. Ruth's identification was apparently a really complicated one, as her bones have been preserved in formaldehyde, which, whilst it is great at preserving bones, is not so great at preserving DNA. It just damages it. David said that it dehydrates the DNA and pulls all of the water out, breaking it down into pieces. So Othram uses the newest technology to sort of piece the DNA back together, a science that I can't even begin to fathom, but they're clearly very, very good at what they do. They got Ruth's DNA profile back to the FBI, who used that in a genealogical search, which led to a close relative of Ruth's. DNA testing then verified her true identity. I have so much faith that this case is one that we're going to see closed, like, and fully solved very, very soon. I really hope Ruth's family are going to be able to make peace with what happened to her. Imagine finding out something like this after so long. And that is my final update of this video. This has been a very long one, so if you made it all the way to the end, thank you so much for sticking it out with me. Like I said earlier, if you ever hear of an update in a case, please do not hesitate to contact me on whichever platform works for you. I don't check message requests all that often, but I do browse occasionally, so there is a chance I would see it. Saying that, perhaps YouTube comments might be the best place, because I do read most of my YouTube comments. Don't forget to sign the petitions, I will leave linked down below. Do your part, and I will see you in the next one. Or should I say, me and Rhubarb will see you in the next one. She has been so needy today. She's not usually very needy. That's why I've let her get away with it, because I'm a bit worried about her, because she's not a very needy cat. Hopefully her purring hasn't been too off-putting for you like it has for me. Her tail has just been in my face for 90% of this video. I started filming this at 10 a.m, didn't I? And now it's about 1:30, so it's gone really well for me. Anyway, with that, thank you for watching. I'll see you in the next one. Bye, guys.